The loneliness one dare not sound and would as soon surmise, as in its grave go plumbing to ascertain the size. The loneliness whose worst alarm is lest itself should see and perish from before itself for just a scrutiny. The horror not to be surveyed, but skirted in the dark, with consciousness suspended and being under lock. I fear me this is loneliness, the maker of the soul, its caverns and its corridors, illuminate or seal.
Hello and welcome to Loneliness and You, the podcast in which we hope to illuminate rather than seal the experience of loneliness and the question of whether it is indeed the maker of the soul. I'm your host, Axel Seemann. In each episode, I have a conversation with someone who has something to say about loneliness, from an academic, artistic, or indeed any other perspective. My guest today is Melba Jensen. Melba, could you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about who you are and what you do?
Hello, Axel. I've been a guide at the Emily Dickinson Museum in Amherst, Massachusetts since 2015. So I've had an 8-year conversation with Emily Dickinson and her poetry in her home on the grounds where she lived almost all of her life and where she did all of her writing, producing the approximately 1,789-ish poems that we have currently documented. I've also, at different points, taught American literature, 19th century American literature, at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
Wonderful. So you are in the best possible position to tell us more about Dickinson, about her life, about the context in which the poem was produced, about which we've talked for a year now. It's amazing to me that you can do that. And what a text that must be, that you can talk about a single poem. It's such a short one as well, for a year, and still not be done with it. So before we, you know, go into your work and your experiences as a tour guide and your knowledge about Dickinson and the place where she lived and worked, I would like to ask you, as I do with all of our guests, what do you do with a poem? How does it strike you? How does it fit into your experience? Anything.
Well, because I read this poem knowing that I would be discussing it with you and your listeners in the context of Dickinson's life and writings, I actually felt a little bit of amusement. And I know that may sound a little odd, but the opening line, "the loneliness one dare not sound," surprised me because Dickinson always dares in her poems. She writes poems where her first line is, "Dare you see a soul at the white heat?" And she invites you to look into this incandescent blaze of her soul. She says, "If he were living, dare I ask?" And she asks, in "Where roses dare not go," one guess where what she says, but that would have to be roses. So the idea that Dickinson, who delighted in exploding the intellectual and cultural norms of her time, dared not sound a particular kind of loneliness struck me as exactly the starting point she would choose for her attempt.
Wonderful. So tell us more about why is that exactly the right starting point? I want to know more now.
Oh, well, one thing I think that Dickinson does in her poems is that she'll begin by starting out with a statement that's really a hypothesis that she intends to explore. And so she has these dramatic opening stanzas, but then she explores it, she unpacks it, she complicates it. You know, in this poem, she's going to try to turn that loneliness around and see what she can find out of it. And she'll end usually with less certainty, but more insight. So that, of course, generates the sense of anticipation. Where is she going to end up with this attempt to sound this loneliness one dare not sound? Why don't you dare sound it? Is there any way you can sound it? All of those questions sort of immediately occurred to me.
Yeah. And I'm hoping we will be able to explore at least some of them. It's interesting that we had one other guest on the podcast who also saw this poem, which is, of course, about a very earnest and serious and grave matter, and it literally talks about the grave, amongst other things. But one other guest also thought that the poem was striking a playful stance. I think the guest said something, it's a sort of a little bit like a peekaboo, where, you know, sort of she's playing with something that she's not supposed to look at or doesn't dare, but then she does it anyway. And she kind of plays with the reader a little bit in this regard. Would you be on board with that?
Oh, absolutely. Her sister-in-law and close friend, Susan Gilbert Dickinson, likened Emily's wit to a Damascus blade. So I think she was able to tolerate all sorts of ambiguities and sort of intellectual discomfort as she would parry with difficult subjects. And I think humor and wit was one of the sort of weapons with which she dealt with her own difficult feelings and emotions.
Let's try to talk a little bit about what it is that she does not dare investigate, look at. How does it continue? Just tell us.
Well, Susan Dickinson also said that Emily was impatient of the fewest words by which she could make her revelation. All right. And I think that speaks to the compression that you experience in a Dickinson poem. They're almost always short, 8 to 12 lines long. I mean, if she really gets into a windy mood, they might run out to 24. But this is not Walt Whitman that we're reading here. So there's probably going to be an unpacking of perspectives that tend to get compacted into similar words, and then a repacking that goes on right at the end of the poem. So when she says that she believes that we should not sound this loneliness, it immediately I sort of wonder, well, is it that we don't do it because this is the loneliness that creates such fear and alarm in us? It's the horror that we don't want to examine. Or is it that we do it badly? And this is where I think she begins to sort of use her wit, because maybe we try to mistakenly scrutinize and plumb loneliness. When she talks about plumbing the grave, I thought this was actually a little bit of a joke. And I think the joke works something like this. Imagine if you ask me to describe death and I answer you by measuring a freshly dug grave. All right, it might be 3 feet by 8 feet by 9 feet. So I say 216 cubic feet. However, 216 cubic feet tells you precisely nothing about death. I've reduced the question to something I can answer, but I've completely bungled it. I wonder if she's pointing out the ways in which our excessive scrutiny, when we sort of try to shine the light of consciousness and reason on a question, we end up making an object out of it that we can measure and describe, and end up obscuring the whole topic that we're in pursuit of, which, you know, is precisely maybe where humor becomes your ally, because it suggests we're going to have to take a sidewise glance at this loneliness rather than try to make it too concrete and too visible, which a poet would probably be in a good position to be aware of. That's the predicament I think she's pointing out, using her humor.
That's a wonderful thought to have. You know, I like the idea that, so here we are, many of my guests, you know, have been philosophers, because, you know, that's what I do. And we have, you know, for a year long, tried to have a very earnest look at loneliness. Mostly it was very earnest, by, you know, means of the help of this poem. And it's a wonderful idea that all of this time she's had the better of it, because actually, you know, she is sort of making a kind of joke here and we've taken it seriously. That's a wonderful idea.
Well, Dickinson had many forms of loneliness, I think, that she had experienced and come to terms with in the course of her life. So we're getting the benefit of all of her first person research in this too.
Yes. And that's, you know, what we should definitely talk about now that I've got you here today. Before we do that, perhaps you could simply give us a little description of her environment as it is preserved today, as we can visit it. You know, many of our guests are not from the area, not even from the United States, so they won't know what this looks like, what the atmosphere is. Describe to us.
Well, if you go to 280 Main Street in Amherst, Massachusetts, you'll find two homes. The first one, which we call the homestead, was built by Emily Dickinson's grandfather, Samuel Fowler Dickinson. And he started out with just a comfortable brick farmhouse in what's called the American Federal style, which means there's four rooms on the first floor and four rooms on the second floor. And you can imagine exactly how they're laid out in the corners of each floor. And Dickinson is born there, she'll die there, she'll live all but 15 years of her life in that home. That home actually, in some ways, becomes, I think, a character in the poems, because for her, one of her metaphors for writing poetry is being a carpenter and being a builder. And she experiences the house as part of that. One of her poems starts out, "Remembrance has a rear and a front. It's something like a house." And then she goes on and she says, "It also has an attic for refuse and the mouse, besides the deepest cellar that Mason ever laid." So immediately the regions of this house are taking on a kind of geography for Dickinson that she, you know, associates with her own writing of the poetry. So there's something the house offers you in terms of just standing in her environment that I think is not necessary to enjoying and understanding her poetry, but it's certainly enriching for it. It also is a beautiful 3-acre property. 2.5 of the original 3 acres remain as part of the museum grounds. There were 11 acres of hayfield across the street that were sold off over time and have become full of houses and trees. But knowing that they were a hayfield and that the house was on the edge of town, I think gives you a sense that Dickinson had a room with a view out of the window. And of course, on the property, her brother, Austin, built a home for himself and Susan Dickinson. So she had her entire family, as well as flower gardens, vegetable gardens, orchards, rose arbors, landscaped terraced gardening that her brother Austin did on his property. She had this very beautiful place to live and work. And most people know that Dickinson became reclusive in her later life. And that sounds often, one you wonder, was there a pathology or a sadness or a disappointment? But I think when you see the grounds, you think, well, along with those things, there certainly was this beautiful world where she had creative control, both in the gardens through her gardening, in the greenhouse, through the plants that she raised through the winter, and through her poetry. And of course, you'll get to talk with the people on your tour who are probably there to share what they know about Dickinson and guides who love to talk about Dickinson.
I must imagine. Yeah. It's funny to think you're right. It's that this poet who writes so eloquently about loneliness as a lived experience, that she was deeply at home somewhere, right? So the exact opposite of somebody like Nietzsche, you know, who just roams the earth and you know, it's just nowhere really. But she's deeply yes, rooted in precisely on a few acres.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes. And despite all of the intellectual and cultural norms that she rejects in her poetry, she does have this sense of being at home at the homestead.
Yeah. I read, you know, I rummaged around a little bit and I came across something she says in some letter to somebody who wanted to visit her later in life and wanted her to go to Boston, but she didn't. And she said, you know, you have to sort of come here, and I'm not leaving, I'm paraphrasing, but I'm not leaving the grounds of my father's house. And she said that, you know, when she was not a young person any longer. So she's very strongly, she seems to have felt this family connection in that property.
I never cross my father's grounds to any place or town.
Right. There you go.
Yes. She said it to Thomas Wentworth Higginson, with whom she carried on a correspondence for 30 years. He was one of her primary recipients of her poetry. He became one of her first editors. It seems to have taken her a long time to educate him about how to read her. But he's very eager. He's accustomed to helping young women in particular find a literary market for their poems. And so he's encouraging her to come to Boston. It's really a very generous offer on his part, but he's surprised when Dickinson says no. But please come visit me. She regularly invites Higginson to visit her. And so it flies a little bit in the face of our notion of her as a recluse. It's not that she didn't see anyone. She just didn't see anyone who wouldn't talk about poetry or literature.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about how this person who, in one sense, you know, was as grounded literally as can be, nevertheless came to experience and express loneliness so intensely. Can you speculate about possible reasons for that? You know, what in her vita may help us understand why she felt so alone?
Yes. Well, I think it's worth first just mentioning that death was an intimate and global experience in a small rural agricultural community in Western Massachusetts at the time that she lives, which is from 1830 when she's born until 1886 when she dies. Nursing was almost always done at home, and so people usually died at home. And she did lose a number of people she was close to, a dear cousin when she was 13, a good friend who had been probably one of the first to see her as a budding poet when she's in her late teens. That isn't particular to Dickinson. That was just the time period. This is a time period where cholera and smallpox and typhus were common epidemics that would periodically sweep through these Western Massachusetts towns. But the things that are particular to Dickinson's life, I think, were that she couldn't profess the doctrines of her family's Congregationalist church. And that really comes to a crux when she's in her final year of formal education. She's at Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, which was one of the most exciting places a young woman could be intellectually at that time. Mary Lyon, the founder, had founded it to provide an education comparable to Yale. All right, so that's quite an aspiration. She couldn't quite manage a four-year course. Most of the young women were training to be teachers. They couldn't afford it. Their families couldn't necessarily afford it. But she did manage a three-year course. So Dickinson does her 1 year. She's doing the second-year coursework at Mount Holyoke Female Seminary. But this is a time when theology was an integral part of higher education. And a revival starts. So she's under extraordinary pressure to profess various adherence to various points of doctrine. The principal one was probably the divinity of Jesus Christ. There's a lot of things that fall out of that we could talk about, but you don't have any trouble with those if you believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ. And I don't think she felt comfortable doing that. She's a bit oblique in what she says in her letters to her friends. She says that it's hard to give up the world and that she couldn't only desire to be good. But the refusal was public. It left her friends concerned for the state of her soul, critical of her spiritual uncertainties, and tone deaf to Dickinson's own pleas for patience with her. And I think that left Dickinson feeling that she had to choose between her integrity and her friends. And that must have been a painful kind of solitude to endure. And this is at roughly the age of 17, 18, probably didn't resolve itself completely until she goes through yet another revival in 1850 when she's 19. And I think she sort of solidifies her choice to persist in her own doubts and inquiries rather than circumvent that by making a public profession that didn't fit her beliefs.
Yeah. What strength is it must take, you know, in that sort of environment to make that sort of choice and stand by it?
Oh, I'm in awe of the confidence and the sort of self-possession of this young woman, you know, because indirectly, too, this is influencing her marriage prospects. Now, it's not clear that Dickinson wanted to marry. What we know is that she remained single throughout her adult life. But she was courted. We know that she enjoyed attending dances and sleighing parties and literary societies and taking horseback rides with young men that she liked. However, the pool of likely suitors were the students at Amherst College. And 40% of those young men went on to be ministers and missionaries. So that was not exactly the pool where a religiously skeptical young woman was going to find a life partner. And I say if she desired to marry, because it is far more likely that she found intimacy with her friend and her sister-in-law, Susan Gilbert Dickinson. Now, Sue was her first reader. She was a trusted editor. She was also Dickinson's inspiration, explicit inspiration for many of the poems. It's likely that they were lovers. Posthumous editing of Dickinson's manuscripts seems to have been deliberately targeted at obscuring Sue's role in Emily's work and life. So we may never reach certainty about the totality of their relationship, but it's certainly the way that the absence has been created is certainly suggestive that her relationship with Sue was the primary one, which sort of uncuts this notion that she was disappointed in heterosexual love. But I feel like it's fair to sort of point out that either way, whether she loved Susan or whether she was disappointed by a man, she had to create intimacy, friendship, and community intentionally, because she wasn't falling into it naturally with the community's norms.
Yeah, interesting. So you can think that this early choice, you know, resulted in an isolation that was spiritual and intellectual and also social.
Yeah.
She was outside of all conventions. And then from there, she had to create, you know, like a much later person. She had to create her own meaning and including, you know, her choice of relationship and attachment. Amazing. Yeah.
Right. And I think she turns to her poetry. She connects with writers by reading their books and their poems. And she develops this correspondence network with 40-ish people who are receiving her poems and her letters and who critically are writing back.
Yeah. It's really like, you know, sort of Sartre writes much later about existential choices where really, you know, you just have to, you make these choices and they really define who you are and there's nothing to fall back on and you create it all from there. And it sounds like, you know, Dickinson's life is sort of a paradigm example of that sort of idea.
Absolutely.
Now, I want to ask you in the few minutes that we've got left, I could talk so much more. It's so interesting.
Yeah.
But so, you know, you have now lived with Dickinson for 8 years. You said in the beginning that you're having an 8 year long conversation with her. What's she like? Like what, you know, just describe her as she's in your mind.
Oh, Dickinson is a lot. I think she could have been quite overwhelming in person. But her poems, I find, particularly this one, I think do address a kind of loneliness in me that I have to take a sidewise glance at, that I can't always get in focus. When she comes down in the end of those poems to those two images of the caves and the corridors, I was puzzled initially, and and then it kind of occurred to me she's playing with the two images of death in the Western literary tradition, or at least unfulfilled life, Plato's cave and Jesus's tomb. And so I thought, oh, heavens, we've got the two ways of knowing, revelation and reason. And then she chooses two unusual words, illuminate and seal. And of course, illumination are these beautiful decorations that were used to embellish manuscripts. And seals are usually the impression of a word or words in wax that's used to close a document. And I know it's almost too easy to come back to say the poem is about poetry, but I really think Dickinson is pointing to poetry as the third way. And it definitely works that way for me, because this poem was probably written in 1863. So that's 160 years ago. So somehow over 160 years, I'm hearing Dickinson's words in my voice. They're resonating in my body. You read them at the beginning of the podcast, you know, so we're all sharing them and I don't feel alone. My loneliness begins to recede when I realize that this is a kind of a little resurrection of Emily's voice. And it may be as close to revelation as I ever get. It's certainly compatible with reason.
That's a wonderful image to end with, that, you know, Emily Dickinson, this poet of loneliness and this, in some respects, very lonely person, can nevertheless guide us towards some sort of resurrection 160 years later. That's beautiful. Thank you so much. I have to say, I did not think about the connection with Plato and the connection with Jesus. And you have truly illuminated the poem for us and contextualized it for us in a way that I'll have to think about for a long, long time. Thank you.
Thank you, Axel.
My guest today was Melba Jensen. Melba is a guide at the Emily Dickinson Museum in Amherst, Massachusetts. She previously taught 19th century American literature at UMass Amherst. Thanks for listening to Loneliness and You, the podcast on the research and experience of loneliness.